Welcome back to M&A Access. My name is Ekaterina. Today, I am joined by Daryl Mezzo. Daryl, thank you so much for being here today. First of all, I know that you drove all the way from Houston to be here today, and that is a long drive. How many hours is that again?
It's about 35 hours. It was about a 3.5 hour drive.
Yeah, but it feels like 35 with the traffic and everything.
For sure.
Yes, yes. So thank you so much for being here today. You have a pretty unique background with Switzerland. And I've done my research on LinkedIn. You speak multiple languages, and you are in M&A legal side of things.
Right.
So let's start with your background. How did you get into M&A?
Well, I am a deal junkie, that's for sure. And before I was a lawyer, I was actually in M&A on the business side. I was in corporate development for an aviation company. Doing corporate development is doing acquisitions and financings and, you know, that same type of thing, but I was doing it more from the business and the finance side. I wasn't doing it from the legal side. And so I was working for several years and then decided to go back to law school. And law school was really just a way for me to reset. And I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but having that background in acquisitions and financing and things like that, I kind of felt like I wanted to use law school as another tool, right? Another arrow in my quiver for doing deals. And then over time, I just realized that I really liked being a lawyer and being a lawyer on the M&A side of things. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did.
Why do you like being a lawyer? I feel like it's such a stressful
job. People don't like being lawyers. You know, I like my clients. I really like my clients. I like helping them get to the next phase in their life. Most of my clients are family-owned businesses, founder-owned businesses. So it's not just about, you know, big businesses where the owners are so far removed from what happens on a day-to-day basis. You know, the owners are involved integrally. Their employees are like part of their family. Their family is involved in the business as well. So when we're doing some type of a transaction, whether it's an acquisition, a divestiture, a refinancing, or bringing in a partner, it impacts the family as a whole. And, you know, they're interesting to work with. They're mm-hmm. nice to work with. They really value opinion. And so it's a good... Mm-hmm. It's a good place to be.
Can we step back a little and clarify your background back in Switzerland? And okay. Why was that part of your journey? I am just dying to know. I feel like it's such a unique path that you went from being basically an international student on the other side of the planet to M&A professional here in America.
Sure. So I went to school in Switzerland. I graduated from school at the American College of Switzerland. But I'm a Texan. I'm from Houston. I went off to school on the East Coast after college, but I really wanted to go to the school in Switzerland. They had come to my school in high school to recruit students, but my parents said, there's no way we're sending you to Switzerland to college, but if you want to take a semester abroad, you know, that would be great. So it was time for me to take a semester abroad, and I went off to the school in Switzerland, and I loved it, so I never came home. So I withdrew, from school and in Philadelphia, and I enrolled in school in Switzerland full time and graduated from there. And I was in Europe off and on for about 10 years before coming back to the States full time.
Mm-hmm. 10 years is a very long time. How is that cultural difference? Did it shock you?
No. You mean cultural difference there mm-hmm. or coming back here?
Both.
No, I mean, when I moved to Switzerland to start school, the school was an American school, right? American education, all the classes were taught in English. Switzerland is actually a great place to be introduced to living kind of in Europe because it's very international. There's so many expatriates that everybody spoke English. You know, so even though it's a different culture, different environment, it was very easy to communicate and get along. And plus, all the students spoke English and were very international themselves. So that was pretty easy, you know, to kind of acclimate, you know, mm-hmm. to being in Europe. And then I was in Paris for a while. That was a little more difficult because it was just being more immersed in a different culture. But that's where I learned to, really learned to speak French. Even though I, you know, I was in the French speaking part of Switzerland, everybody spoke English. Mm-hmm. So while I could learn to understand it, I didn't really learn to speak it. So it wasn't until I went to spend more time in France that I picked up
and
the ability to speak.
Why did you came back to Texas?
Well, I actually came back and went to law school in Miami, mm-hmm. at University of Miami. And then from Miami, I moved to Colorado. And from Colorado, I moved to California, to San Diego. And then from San Diego, I moved back to Houston. So it was quite a journey. I've lived in different places. But at the end of the day,
Houston is the best.
You can take the boy out of Texas, but you can't take Texas out of the boy. So I came back to be closer to family.
How did that international experience help to build your character in M&A things as well, maybe, as well as just personal life, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it gave me a more worldly view. And I don't mean that, you know, kind of in a... I guess in a, you know, I'm not trying to say anything about other people, right? But I met people from all over the world, and you know, was immersed in with different cultures. You know, not just being in Switzerland around Swiss people, or in France around French people, but around people from all over the globe. And even to this day, most of my best friends are people that I met while I was living in Switzerland, who are all over. Any place I go, I basically have family, whether it's in Europe or in Asia or in South America. I mean, I got to know a lot about a lot of different cultures. I think that gave me, like I said, a little bit more of a worldly view and not just so myopic about what happens in Texas or what happens in the U.S. and how it impacts a client. I mean, I have clients right now, for example, and we might get into this later on, but that are impacted by the tariffs, right? And so kind of understanding, you know, how that's affecting them, also because of where the products are being manufactured that are then being brought back here and being subject to tariffs. So mm-hmm. I have maybe a little bit more of a way to understand that. Mm-hmm.
You have a very rich background, a very diverse for sure too. And with all of those experiences, you chose M&A world. Why? What is it about M&A legal side of things that attracts you so much?
Well, I mean, I think whether it's legal or anybody else that's in the deal world, I think that they just like being, me for, in particular, I like being exposed to different industries and different people and different types of deals, working with different people on a regular basis. You know, the owners of companies are all different. The buyers of the companies are all different. The people financing them are all different. So it's like it's dealing with a lot of different personalities all the time. And every deal, like you could have two deals that are in the same industry, the same size, but each deal has its own nuance and its own unique issues, maybe. And so I think it's a little bit of variety. You know, mm-hmm. variety is the spice of life, and mm-hmm. doing deals is variety almost on a daily basis.
So from your experience, since you said every deal is unique, what is the most important, I guess, part of the deal from your perspective?
That's a good question. I think the most important part of a deal is really understanding my client's need, right? I mean, I think as a lawyer, it's not my job to kind of dictate how the deal is going to go. It's my job to understand what the client wants and needs and make sure that that's how the deal ends up getting done.
Absolutely. And another thing too, any legal things, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know the terminology, but they include a lot of emotions, I feel like. It's a very stressful job. So how do you balance if both buyers and sellers are on the verge of some spicy emotions? How do you manage that?
But they really shouldn't be, right? The best deals are the deals where everybody's happy. You know, there are too many times when you hear about transactions where the lawyers on each side are kind of battling each other, or the buyer and seller are battling each other. But the objective is the same for both sides. I mean, so the best deals are the ones where you know, where people are really looking to accomplish exactly the same thing, right? When the buyer and seller are looking to accomplish exactly the same thing, right? Because they really are, you know, the attorneys for the buyer and the attorneys for the seller, they shouldn't be battling each other, because we're just trying to find a way to make our clients happy. And the way our clients are going to be happy is if a deal gets done where they're both happy, you know? So it's not like litigation where there's, you know, there are two sides and you're fighting. It's really one, you know, there's really one side and you're trying to find a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, so I try to put myself in, if I'm representing a seller, I try to put myself in the buyer's shoes too, because I've been in that position many times in what's important to them. So you're not just looking at it from one side of the deal, because you really have to make sure that when it closes, everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm. Without naming any names, any companies, can you share a story of your favorite deal? Maybe something funny happened. Maybe something went wrong. Maybe in a good or a bad way.
Yeah, well, I won't name names and I won't name the industry, but it's a deal that happened last year that ended up falling apart. And I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but it's a very memorable deal, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I don't know how to describe a favorite deal, but it's a deal, you know, that's very memorable because I represented the seller, and it's a family-owned business. This was a third-generation owner. He had been very successful. He was very young, but he had, you know, a lot of kids, and the kids were young, and it was important for him to be able to spend more time with his family and with his kids. His kids were homeschooled, and he wanted to be a part of their lives. And so he thought, you know, he'd like to sell the business, and coincidentally, a strategic buyer, a very large company, public company, made an inquiry to see if he'd be interested in selling. And so we went down a path of trying to, you know, get the deal done. And it took a long time to negotiate the letter of intent. But everybody seemed to be on board with the terms in the letter of intent. And then we started to negotiate the agreements. And all of a sudden, the deal terms started to change. The buyer started to change all of the terms. And my client was just didn't know what to do, because he really wanted to sell the company so he could, you know, do what was important for him from a life, you know, standpoint. But it got to the point where almost every single term had changed. While the price stayed the same, the way to get to that price had changed. How long he was going to have to stay on board changed. So all these things that just made it too difficult for him to sell. So we ended up having to walk away, you know, from the transaction because it was just both sides started to not like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say I know why they started to not like each other. I know why my client started not to like the other side, because they were changing the terms of the deal so drastically. But I don't know why the other side just all of a sudden just felt like they were the 800-pound gorilla and they were going to dictate, you know, how it was going to end up being. And they thought that my client was just going to go along with it, and he just didn't. And so that was memorable because it really ended up bad.
Mm-hmm. Drama.
A lot of drama, yeah.
And kind of maybe looking back at previous big M&A deals, for example, when Facebook bought Instagram, or when Disney bought Pixar, you know, things like that. And you're just looking at those deals and you're like, oh God, I wish I don't want to be a part of that ever. I'm glad I'm not. Or maybe, oh my God, I would love to be part of this.
It's funny you talk about Disney and Pixar, because I just finished listening to Bob Iger's biography, and he talked about the purchase of Pixar, and right now I'm listening to Steve Jobs' biography, and I'm at the point where they just are selling, you know, Pixar to Disney. And, you know, it just would have been really interesting to be in the room, you know, even just a fly on the wall to hear those negotiations, and because it's just things that are a part of our everyday life. You know, Disney's a part of our life. When I was living in California, I would go to Disneyland all the time, right? And our kids love, you know, Disney stuff and Pixar. I mean, who doesn't like all those, you know, Toy Story and you know, Finding Nemo. Those are just, but those kind of make up our life, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's been kind of cool to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. So that does not scare you?
No, it doesn't scare me. I mean, I think the size of a deal doesn't necessarily change how a deal is done, right? I mean, there may be more parties involved. There may be more dollars, you know, more commas, mm-hmm. you know, for the number of zeros that you have. But, you know, deals are still done pretty much the same way. I don't work on public company transactions. My deals are almost exclusively private, so I don't have to deal with, you know, some of those types of issues. You know, we're talking with public companies and public company voting requirements and that kind of thing. But no, that would be pretty fun to, I mean, I love my clients, right? I love dealing, like I said, with the families and with the people that invest in family-owned businesses. But it would have been pretty cool to be a part of a deal like that.
Mm-hmm. So you said every deal is done the same. How did that change over time, especially with AI being in the world now?
Yeah, well, I guess when maybe I don't want to people to misunderstand what I say. When I say all deals are done the same, I don't mean that every deal is structured differently. Every deal has its own nuances, like I was saying. But, you know, a transaction is going to be either, you know, you're going to buy the whole thing, you're not going to buy the whole thing. You're going to buy the assets or you're going to buy the entity. You know, you're going to do it with cash, you're going to do it with stock. I mean, so, you know, not every deal is exactly the same or done exactly the same. But whether it's a large transaction or a small transaction, it's still the same type of deal, mm-hmm. right? So.
And how does AI implement or help your work nowadays?
Oh, I mean, so funny because it's a big topic of conversation. You know, some lawyers think that AI will never replace what lawyers do. And other lawyers say, you know, that, you know, will be obsolete. I actually embrace AI. I mean, I think it's been really helpful even in these early stages because it still is in its infancy. So, you know, we have within our legal databases, like in Westlaw, something called CoCounsel. And CoCounsel can not only help, I could say, you know, draft a purchase agreement for a food company who contract manufactures all their product in South America with, you know, all the stuff. And CoCounsel will spit out a good template of an agreement. Now, I wouldn't use that agreement as the end result, you know, what I would put in front of a client or put in front of the other side, but it helps come up with things that maybe you didn't think about. Or I could use, you know, AI to help me, the CoCounsel to help me find out what's new in the market for the length of an indemnification, reps and warranties and indemnification, and what that language is. And it could help me craft that language based on what's new in the market, right? The new market norms. So I think AI in that context is fantastic. And I also think it benefits the client because where it could take hours and hours of research that we have to charge the client, AI can spit it out, I mean, in I wouldn't say minutes, right? But it helps make us more efficient. We spend less time doing it, so we charge the client, you know, less, which, you know, maybe people don't want to hear. Other lawyers might not want to hear that, but I think it's great because anything that benefits the client is good for us, and it provides us with much more information and allows us to do many more things so we can satisfy more clients.
Mm-hmm. And with more and more younger individuals taking over M&A world, also with Gen Zers, I'm Gen Z, that combined with AI, how do you think that will look within the next 5 to 10 years? Are we doomed? Is it going to be better? Is it going to be worse?
So you mean from the context of working on M&A deals?
Yes.
Or the types of deals that are done? Or
yes, in M&A world with more younger individuals, with AI help, how do you see that combination working in the long term, looking ahead 10 years from now or 5?
I mean, I think it's great. You know, I mean, I think technology will never replace, you know, the human element of everything, but I think it can definitely help. I mean, I think it'll allow, you know, when you say younger versus older, I'm still pretty younger. No, I mean, I think, you know, whether it's the Gen Z or whatever generation you want to call it, I mean, there are a lot of opportunities to do various types of deals, you know, and there's also opportunity to create new companies. I mean, deals, I work in the lower middle market. That's primarily where I do a lot of my transactions. But there's also a lot of new startup type opportunities, you know, for people who are doing deals, but it's finding ways to invest in new companies and you know, using AI and other technology, first to identify the types of companies that might be out there, but also to maybe help figure out how to do more types of deals themselves. I don't think anybody should, you know, play lawyer and be their own lawyer. That's not necessarily a smart thing. But I think that you can use AI to help understand and craft you know, the structure of a deal or certain preliminary types of documents or things that don't need a lawyer, mm-hmm. right? Like negotiating certain business terms. I mean, I'm not sure if that's exactly the point that you were getting at, but I do think AI benefits everybody in all different industries. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just a good thing.
Mm-hmm. For those who are just entering the M&A world, going back to the younger individuals, Gen Z, or whoever we want to mention here, what kind of advice would you give them? Where to even start?
I mean, there's so many different aspects of being in the deal community. And I think, you know, being a lawyer is just one, right? There's also being, you know, there are different types of consultants who maybe help identify companies to acquire on behalf of a client. There's private equity that, you know, or that are the capital providers, basically sponsoring, doing deals, you know, on behalf of their investors. You know, there are banks that are part of the deal world, you know, and then there are insurance companies that are providing reps and warranty insurance. So these are, like I said, investment banks. There are all sorts of people, accountants that are doing, you know, accounting firms that are doing quality of earnings reports. So they're all different types of businesses that participate in the M&A community. So I think what you need to do if you're young and starting out and trying to figure out, you know, what your path is, you know, what are you passionate about? And you can be passionate about doing a deal, but from what standpoint, right? So I think try to understand what you love to do. I mean, if you like the legal side, I like drafting agreements and I like helping structure things, but I can tell you, I don't think I would want to be like on the accounting side doing quality of earnings reports, but that's just as much a part of the deal community as what I do. You know, so I think try to understand what you're good at, what you like to do, and spend time figuring out the best way to enter the deal world from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Right. And also realize that, you know, if you're young, you're young. You can make mistakes and you might decide that your path, you know, in 10 years is not what you thought it would be 10 years ago. Right. Maybe you decide you want to do something different. I worked for 7-8 years before I decided to go to law school. Right. And then even after that, it took me a while to figure out where within the legal community I wanted to be. Right. So I think if you're young, just, you know, don't feel like you're trapped in whatever you do as your first job out of college, or if you didn't go to college, you know, use it as a stepping stone to something else, or maybe understand that you want to do it, you know, from a different standpoint. But so there are all different ways to be in the deal world. There's not just one.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you have seen different legal communities around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say Houston market and legal community is the best one to start with, or is it too much responsibility in a way?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, Houston is a big city and Houston has a lot of lawyers and it's a very robust legal community doing all sorts of different things. I mean, I think people, somebody wants to become an attorney, I would say, and this is advice I wish I would have gotten when I went to law school, that if you want to go to law school and you have an idea of where you think you want to live, go to a law school that's kind of in that area, because that's where you're going to meet a lot of people that are going to be your peers, you know, and where you're going to generate a lot of referrals and just be a part of that legal community, you know. So I would say that's something. So if you feel like you want to be in Houston, you know, maybe being in law school in Texas someplace would be a good thing to do. But the legal community in Houston is very strong. You know, there are a lot of great attorneys. There are a lot of great law firms. There are a lot of international law firms that have come into town and are just doing a lot of good stuff. I mean, there's all sorts of ends of the market. You know, they're the very big firms that are doing very large transactions, like the Pixar, Disney, you know, types of transactions. There are law firms in Houston that, you know, their transactional attorneys are focused more on the energy space, you know, on oil and gas. And then there are some that are focused more on renewable energy and alternative energy sources. But I think what people can't forget is that Houston is a robust economy with lots of different types of industries. You know, it's not just an oil and gas driven economy. So there's opportunity to be in various aspects of the law in lots of different industries, and, you know, being the fourth largest city in the country, you know, there's a lot of growth. I mean, so there's just, it's a good place to be.
Mm-hmm. And what, if someone is just trying to enter that Houston ecosystem, if you will, what is something they need to know? Absolutely.
Well, I think this would go for any place, not just in Houston, is you've got to get out there and start meeting people. And I was talking to one of my associates about that today. You know, young associates, they, you know, have to understand it's not just about being in the office and waiting for the partner to give you work. I mean, that is a big part of what associates do, but I think it's really important to get out and start meeting your peers, you know, because those are the people that are going to help you along the way and who you're going to be able to help along the way, because you're growing up together in your business life, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that would be really, really important, is network, you know, be a part of different networking, you know, business organizations that are a part of what you like to do, whether it's industry focused or whether it's M&A focused, you know, or it's, you know, banking or, you know, the legal community. I mean, I'm a part of the Houston Bar Association and different sectors within the Houston Bar Association. So I get to meet people that are, you know, in the M&A community in the Houston Bar, but I'm also part of, you know, AMNAA and all the, you know, different organizations that are part of the deal community. But I also, you know, am involved in, you know, some other organizations that are more industry focused, like, you know, food and beverage that I do a lot of stuff in. So I think just, you know, get out there and start networking in the market and in the industry and in the, you know, professional space that you're a part of.
Mm-hmm. Just keep shaking hands.
Shake as many hands as you can.
So what are some regulatory or legal trends you are watching closely right now?
I don't know about regulatory, but I alluded to it a little bit earlier that, you know, tariffs have played a big part in what's going on in the M&A world, at least for me, you know, this past year. So that's one thing that I continue to keep, you know, my eye on. And I'm waiting for the Supreme Court to decide whether or not, you know, that the tariffs will stay in place. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's even how they're going to decide it, you know. But that's been a big part, because a lot of what I do and a lot of what a lot of companies are doing here in the United States, they're importing either raw materials or they're importing finished goods. And tariffs have been have played a big part in the what's gone on from a deal standpoint, at least in my practice, you know, this year, because with tariffs, margins are compressed. So companies may not be as profitable, and they don't know if they're, you know, going to have to raise their prices, you know, for consumer goods, or even if it's, you know, selling product, you know, to, you know, if they're selling, widgets, you know, to some other manufacturing company, mm-hmm. you know, that could be impacted by tariffs. And so I think that's really had a pretty significant impact on deals, some of them not happening, some of them being pushed off until there's more clarity on what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I call that regulatory, but it's definitely something that's, you know, been a significant factor.
Mm-hmm. So if you had a magic wand and you could just wave it at people who are preparing for a transaction, and maybe everybody's making the same mistakes in the beginning, what is something that you wish everybody knew before jumping into a deal, transaction, on a legal side?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in the lower middle market, like I said, where I spend most of my time, business owners are great at what they do, making that widget, again, as an example. But they may not know much about the deal world. And so I think, you know, it's not just a decision, do I buy or do I not? I mean, do I sell or do I not sell? You know, there are various shades of gray. You know, lots of different reasons to do a transaction, ways to do a transaction. So I would say, you know, don't go into it blindly. Ask as many questions of as many different people as you can, whether they're in the space, whether they're part of the M&A world, or it's a friend that had a company that did a transaction. But, you know, don't be afraid to go out and ask questions and get different advisors around you, right? You know, that's probably the best thing to do. And even if you're not ready to do a deal, start reaching out to whether it's investment bankers or your, you know, accountant in your tax or your tax accountant or, you know, your attorney. I mean, I think one thing that people don't do often enough is reach out to their attorney or get an M&A attorney involved until after they've signed a letter of intent. That's not always the best thing. I mean, I'm not saying that we're going to drive a transaction. We shouldn't. This should always be a business decision. But, you know, getting an attorney involved earlier on, you can help strategize. And it's one thing I do with my clients all the time, you know, because I'm a lawyer, but I'm also a corporate finance guy and I've run businesses, et cetera. So, you know, attorneys can be helpful in other ways besides just drafting documents, but so can investment banks. And so can your accountant. And so, you know, various people who are part of the community, they can help give you, you know, some advice. So don't be afraid to start asking these questions long before you've decided mm-hmm. to pull the trigger.
Where can people connect with you and how can they get in touch with you for sure. more legal advice?
Well, you can always find me on LinkedIn as well. But I'm a partner at Shackelford, McKinley & Norton in Houston. We have offices in Houston and Dallas, Fort Worth and Austin. But I'm in the Houston office and, you know, our website is Shackelford, Shackelford.law. So you can find us there.
Awesome. Daryl, thank you so much for visiting me today. Thank you for your time. Thank you for driving here for 35 hours. This has been very insightful. I had a pleasure.
Great.
Meeting you.
No, this was fantastic. Thanks for including me.
And thank you so much for listening to M&A Access. Don't forget to check out our video version of the podcast on our YouTube channel. And until next time, stay tuned.